Concerto for Orchestra by Brahms centenary composer Witold Lutosławski. Anthony Witt conducting the Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra at the Proms this Friday night. Anthony Witt returning to the stage. You may have noticed in the toccata section of the finale, Lutosławski inscribing Shostakovich's well-known musical monogram DSCH, or D, E flat, C and B natural, as translated into musical notation. For Lutosławski, Shostakovich represented a major composer responding through his music to a political crisis, a concern that Lutosławski understood only too well. In 1948, his first symphony had been banned by the Polish government. The music that he wrote over the next few years, culminating in his concerto for orchestra, was his spirited response. Shostakovich to come next, the second piano concerto, and then the sixth symphony in the second half of tonight's prom. Anthony Witt going around the orchestra section by section. They're all on their feet now. Stephen Stuckey, the composer, puts it in his monograph on Lutosławski. The concerto was enthusiastically received by critics and audiences alike. It immediately established Lutosławski as the foremost composer of his time. This is Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, as we start a holiday weekend that includes the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, Parsifal from the Halle, light organ music, and the John Wilson Orchestra. Full details at the Proms website, and every note of the Proms live here on Radio 3. Well, a slight hiatus now as a piano has moved into place. While that happens, let's hear a bit more about tonight's orchestra making their Proms debut. Let's join Proms reporter Georgia Mann, who is in one of the loggia boxes here at the Royal Albert Hall, with the Warsaw Philharmonic's Deputy Director, Wojtek Nowak.
Thanks, Petrok. Yes, I'm amidst the plush red velvet of a loggia with a real ringside view of the Warsaw Philharmonic, which is handy for their Deputy Director, Wojtek Nowak, who, as you say, is with me right now. Ms. Nowak, it's the first time the Warsaw Philharmonic have played the Proms, but they certainly sound pretty much at home already. How has the experience been so far?
Good evening. Yes, the experience is wonderful so far. And really, I must say that we are very, very happy that we can perform at the Proms. It's a great pleasure for us to be here after so many years that the festival is running. It's one of the most important festivals in the Europe, in the world. And I believe that it's the first time a Polish orchestra is playing at the festival. So it's for us a very big occasion tonight, very big day. And I hope that the public who's listening to us here, the full house, and all the people who are listening on radio will enjoy it.
Lots of firsts, and as you say, a very full house. But how important is it for you as an orchestra to be playing Polish music like the Lutosławski, which we just heard, the Panufnik still to come for us this evening? Do you feel that there's a real responsibility for you to bring this music to the rest of the world, to act as ambassadors for it?
Yes, of course. We always like to play Polish music whenever we can, and it's a great pleasure for us to play Lutosławski here, especially when we take into account that it's 100th anniversary of his birth this year. And we always try to play as much Polish music as possible. Of course, not always it's possible, but such occasions as tonight, when we can play Lutosławski Concerto for Orchestra, which was written, as a matter of fact, for our orchestra back in the 50s, and then we can play Andrzej Panufnik, a composer who was one of the first directors of the orchestra and was establishing the orchestra after the Second World War, it's a great pleasure. It's a wonderful feeling to have this chance to do it.
And to hear the music of those two great friends together. You are a very Polish orchestra, quite literally, in that I think I'm right in saying you have only one musician from the Ukraine, one from the States, and I just wondered, how do you think that manifests itself as a sound? I mean, how would you perhaps characterise the sound of the Warsaw Philharmonic?
Well, we are a very Polish orchestra. It's true that we don't have too many international musicians in the orchestra yet, but it will most probably change, like it changed in all the orchestras in Europe. But we want to keep our sound, the sort of Slovenic sound, and we want to be recognized for that sound. And I hope that with the concert this evening, the public of the BBC Proms will remember the sound, and hopefully we can come back and play again.
Don't worry about this. This goes on all the time, I can assure you. There is a sadness perhaps tonight because Maestro Witt, the orchestra's artistic director, is sort of stepping back a little bit. He's going to still be guest conducting the orchestra, but this is his last concert as artistic director. Is there a little bit of sadness there tonight?
Yes, of course. It's a great joy for us to be here for the first time, but it is sad that we are saying goodbye to Maestro Witt, who's after 11 very successful seasons leaving the orchestra. But of course he will be coming back as a guest conductor. We already have dates fixed for the next season and for the one after that. So he will definitely be working with us in the future. And we are looking forward to working with him in the future also.
He'll never be too far away. Mr. Novak, thank you so much. I think the piano is going to be skirted back into position very soon for the Shostakovich. So I'll let you get back to your seat. Back to you, Petrok.
Georgia, thank you very much indeed. Yes, that heave-ho marking the ceremonial opening of the piano lid, ready for Alexander Melnikov to play Shostakovich's second piano concerto. Like the Lutosławski, another creation of the 1950s, Shostakovich himself pronounced it a work of no artistic value, written as an amusement for his son Maxim. Yet as ever with Shostakovich, the story is surely far more complicated than that. I've been talking to Melnikov and asked what he makes of Shostakovich's musical message in this concerto.
Well, I think he made a point of never being clear about what message he is trying to get across, so to say. At the same time, his music is as idiomatic as it gets in getting across the message, so I think we should just follow his advice and not elaborate on that. Whoever will hear something will get the message which music can convey, and probably no words can
convey. And yet you say in notes that you've written on the piece that in the last movement, for example, the sarcasm, the irony, the questions that appear in the piece, you say can only really be understood by someone who lived in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, because of course there is a lot of this music which is on the border with vulgarity, if you want, but whether we should take it as vulgar or as ironic, I mean, it's up to us. I haven't performed at the proms before, but all my colleagues who did always told me about this incredible celebratory atmosphere and sparkling happiness. I mean, probably there is not a better piece to illustrate this atmosphere than the second piano concerto, because it being, as we said, a complex work, apart from incredible lyricism and vulgarity / sarcasm, it has a lot of pure joy. And I do hope that this is something I'll manage to get across.
Well, a slight look of shock on the face there of the leader of the Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra, Eva Marchik, as she played the air. She's now turning around and laughing at the promos, laughing with the promos, perhaps it might be better to say, as the orchestra tune ready for Shostakovich's second piano concerto. Just to date it, composed in 1956-57, immediately before Shostakovich began work on the mammoth 11th Symphony. David Gutman, in his programme note, says it's tempting to read into the music something of the optimism and sense of freedom that followed Stalin's death. But as he reminds us, these were hard times for Shostakovich. His first wife had recently died, got himself entangled into an unsuitable and short-lived second marriage. It wasn't entirely for him a time of celebration. So an expectant hush falls over the Royal Albert Hall. The arena absolutely jam-packed this evening with promos. Lots of Polish music fans in London turning out to support what is Poland's leading symphony orchestra, though no flags on display yet. Maybe we'll see those in part two this evening. And here comes Alexander Melnikov. Behind him, Antoni Witt. Melnikov also, like all the artists tonight, making his proms debut. So he joins the Warsaw Philharmonic, Shostakovich's second piano concerto.
Thank you. Thank you.
Alexander Melnikov playing Shostakovich's second piano concerto. Anthony Witt conducting the Warsaw Philharmonic. Written, says Melnikov, in traditional free movement concerto form, but each movement, he says, has the slight aftertaste of not belonging to the other two. Somehow everything is right, yet it is wrong. Could it be a joke, he continues, of course. And we listen to the first movement, initially dazzled with almost populist simplicity, but then even the smallest attempt to listen a bit more deeply, the first movement with its slightly wrong offset rhythms and harmonies, make us shift uneasily in our seat. From Melnikov's introduction to his critically acclaimed recording of both the first and second piano concertos of Shostakovich. He's back on the stage now, as Anthony Witt brings the Warsaw Philharmonic to its feet. Alexander Melnikov, born in Moscow in 1973. He was 12 when he made his public debut, playing Rachmaninoff's first piano concerto. Very heavily influenced as an artist by Sviatoslav Richter. Tatiana Nikolaeva gave an acclaimed last night performance of Shostakovich's second piano concerto in 1992. She, of course, very closely associated with Shostakovich, recorded his 24 preludes and fugues, as Melnikov has himself. He's back on stage alone this time. Bows to the audience and to the orchestra as he leaves the stage. Yes, that recording of the 24 preludes and fugues, released in 2010, described by BBC Music Magazine as one of the 50 greatest recordings of all time. And to stamping and heavy clapping from the arena, he's back on stage for an encore. Yes, pulls out the piano stool and sits down. Beau d'artifice, fireworks from Debussy's Preludes, played by Alexander Melnikov, one of the first members of Radio 3's New Generation Artist Scheme back in 2000. His time on that led to several creative partnerships that endure for him to this day. Also introduced him to the world of historically informed performance. Plays forte piano a lot now. Back on the platform again, I have to say that encore listened to by lots of people standing in the aisles. Kept us waiting. But lots of people stopped in their tracks when he returned and sat down at the keyboard to play Debussy, making his Proms debut this evening, Alexander Melnikov. Well, that brings us to the interval this Friday night. Two works by Panufnik coming up, his Tragic Overture and Lullaby, and then we'll hear Shostakovich's Sixth Symphony. During the next 20 minutes, a Proms Plus discussion recorded just before this concert over the road at the Royal College of Music and introduced there by Andrew McGregor.
Here at the Royal College of Music, we're going to be finding out a great deal more about the two Polish composers in this evening's Prom, Witold Lutosławski and Andrzej Panufnik, with the help of my two guests. Panufnik's daughter and a successful composer in her own right, Roxana Panufnik, and Dr. Nicholas Rayland, who's senior lecturer in music and film studies at Kiel University with a particular interest in Polish music and film. So, Nick, perhaps you might give us a brief idea of the period in Polish culture and history from which this evening's music emerges.
Yes, the music in tonight's Prom comes from one of the most tragic and dramatic passages in relatively recent Polish history, the passage from the peak of World War II to the peak of Stalinism in Poland just over a decade later. So Panufnik's Tragic Overture, Andrzej Panufnik's Tragic Overture, composed in 1942, reconstructed after the war for reasons we'll probably come on to in 1945, is very much a wartime composition. There was then a brief period of relatively optimistic, albeit cautious optimism, and rebuilding in Poland after World War II. And some of the fruits of this period of rebuilding are a series of works Panufnik composed in 1947, including Lullaby, which is an extraordinary composition, as I'm sure we'll talk about as well. However, that progress, that rebuilding was about to be hijacked by Stalinist communism. And as the progressive socialist government in Poland gave way to a Stalinist communist government, the cult of the individual takes hold, and we move into a period when composers were asked to write socialist realist music, music essentially with a propaganda purpose to convert hearts and minds to the Stalinist version of communism. And Lutosławski's Concerto for Orchestra is very much a product of these times, and yet it's perhaps the only masterpiece to emerge from Poland during these times, and it's a work which both represents and transcends the circumstances of its production.
Now, Roxana Panufnik, the music we're going to hear in the second half of the Prom was written by her father in the 1940s, also revised in the 50s. Would you say it was typical of his musical language at the time?
His musical language at that time was going through a great state of change. I mean, we have to remember, despite all the hideous things they'd been through with the Second World War and the Warsaw Uprising and then the communists coming in, he was still only in his early 30s. So he was still very much forming as a person as well as a composer. And but the sort of germs of the ideas that he then used as building blocks for the rest of his works, the rest of his life, were being born. And Tragic Overture is a great example of, it's the very start of him finding a four-note cell, a selection of four notes that he bases the whole piece on, with great imagination and variety, but keeping this little four-note motif going. And we see that develop throughout his works over the next 40, 50 years.
I was talking to you before we came on stage, and you were saying that actually, in some ways, you've been coming to your own father's music really rather late in life.
Yes, I'm very ashamed to say that I don't know much about his music at all, and this is for a few reasons. First of all, he died just as I was becoming an adult, and just as I was about to begin to really understand and empathize with him as a person and as a composer. I'd also been studying composition at the Royal Academy of Music, and there were a few snide remarks about nepotism and so on, and I purposefully actually avoided studying his music too much and knowing too much about his music initially for that reason. And then as I was over the last 20 years particularly trying to develop my own personal compositional voice, I was worried about, you know, somehow his influence creeping in, which actually it has, because genetically I am wired to be like him as a composer and as a person. So now I revel in it, of course.
And now you're having to, well, listen to his music more anyway, because people are asking you for things for his centenary next year.
Yes, my whole year this year has been taken up with commissions that are in memory of my father, and I've just done this piece called Two Composers, Four Hands, which we might hear a bit about later. About it's an in memoriam for Lutosławski and my father, and it's about their piano duo during the Second World War, their underground duo.
Well, let's talk about that straight away, because okay. They were friends, and they played together as this duo in Nazi-occupied Warsaw during the war, and it must have had a huge effect on every aspect of their lives, Nick.
The war.
Yeah, and just the cultural conditions.
They didn't expect to come out of it alive. Mm-hmm. I think that's the first most striking thing to say. And Poles in this period were incredibly active and inventive in finding ways of keeping musical life and their idea of education going in a kind of black market of music and education beneath the Nazi radar. And it was a vessel for Polishness. Displays of Polishness were, of course, banned by the Nazis. But there were ways and means around this. The duo they formed was partly practical. It was a way of making money. Many intellectuals and musicians and artists were finding work in the cafe culture of the time, whether you were a doorman taking coats, having given up your philosophy position in the local faculty, or a composer playing in a piano duo. And they had this duo to make money, to help support their families, and also as a way of keeping some thread of their developing musicalities going in a public form. The cafes were essential in all kinds of ways. There wasn't much heating, there wasn't much coal, so people would gather in these Polish Warsaw cafes, partly for warmth and company, and to exchange gossip and rumour, and there you'd hear music such as Panofnika and Lutosławski's.
Now, the only thing that actually survives, as far as I'm aware, is Lutosławski's Paganini Variations, which was written for the pair of them. But what do we know about the kind of music they would play and sort of how adventurous they were?
It was an enormous variety of music. They were doing transcriptions of enormous 19th century symphonic works. They were doing jazz works, Gershwin arrangements. They improvised a lot, both in the style of jazz, but also in lots of different styles. And Nick was telling me earlier about how one of them would play the melody of a Schubert Lieder, and then the other would be improvising a sort of Ravelian accompaniment for it. It's the kind of stuff that you wish you were there, and it would be fantastic to try and see if there's anyone who could ever recreate it. But it was an enormous variety.
And there's
no
recording, is there,
no.
Sadly?
No.
Such a shame. What you'd pay to hear them actually doing this.
Oh, well, indeed. And the only surviving score is the Paganini Variations of all those many transcriptions, hundreds, maybe over 1,000 arrangements and transcriptions they produced. Lutosławski left with what he could in a handcart during the Warsaw Rising, the rebellion against the Nazis, and eventually the tragic defeat of the rebellion as the Nazis razed Warsaw before abandoning it to the Soviet Union. And he escaped with a few of his own scores and the Paganini Variations, and couldn't take the many, many, many other pieces that he'd written with Panofnik.
Now, we do find out quite a lot about Panofnik's feelings at the time through the Tragic Overture, written in 1942, and, well, it doesn't sound as though he held back at all on how he felt about life in occupied Poland.
Yes, there are two contrasting ways in which the Tragic Overture seems to represent wartime experience. One, Panofnik said, was essentially accidental or unconscious. The work includes, he realized when he heard it in performance, various what he called onomatopoeic sound, essentially orchestral effects mimicking life in wartime Warsaw. So one famous effect we'll hear is a long trombone downwards glissando about two-thirds of the way through the piece, which is the sound of a Messerschmitt disappearing into the distance and that kind of auditory Doppler effect as it disappears, he realized after writing the piece. There's also a powerful exchange of machine gun and artillery fire, he later realized, towards the climax of the piece, and then a final shriek of anguish at the very end of the composition. He realized these essentially programmatic elements had found their way into the music, slightly to his surprise. But it's also a piece which feels tragic in structure and tragic in terms of its musical drama.
If you look at the programme of the Tragic Overture, it says written 1942, reconstructed 1945. What happened to the music?
My father left Warsaw with his family, took them away at the worst point towards the sort of climax of the uprising to try and get them to safety. And, of course, they had to leave in a hurry. He left everything behind. And he tells the story of coming back to his old apartment after everything's finished and died down. And he gets there, and it's the place is a terrible wreck. There are fires burning in the courtyard. You know, people have chucked out. They've moved in like magpies and chucked the old residents' possessions outside. And he goes up to his apartment, and this strange lady is there. And he says, this was my apartment. And she says, yes. And he said, have you seen some scores? And she said, scores? What are scores? And he said, well, you know, my music, this big pile of paper, manuscript paper with lots of music written on it. And I said, oh, that old rubbish. Oh, I threw that out. And he suddenly, it clicked, and he ran down to the bonfire in the courtyard. And there were little fragments of the scores on this bonfire. So he had to reconstruct everything. And it's amazing. I don't know how he remembered everything. And actually, for some of his more symphonic works, he wasn't happy with the reconstruction and just abandoned them and decided to move on altogether. But the Tragic Overture, I think one of the reasons why he managed to reconstruct that so successfully is because it's based on this very distinct four-note motif. And he probably could remember how he developed that and what he did with it and the atmosphere of it all. So
there's a structure which actually helped him find how the piece worked a second time. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the other piece by Andrzej Panufnik we're going to hear in the second half, his Lullaby from 1947. Now, it was inspired by London, but before he actually came to live here. So what was the catalyst for the piece, Roxana?
Well, while he was trying to put all these orchestras back together, obviously a lot of the orchestral libraries had been completely destroyed. And he came to London in 1947 to get some more music, some more scores and parts for the orchestras back home. And he, one night at about 1 a.m., he couldn't get to sleep, so he decided to go for a walk around London, around the town, and everything was very quiet and very still. Be quite different now at 1 a.m. nowadays. But then in 1947, he found himself on Waterloo Bridge, and he was looking out at the water. And the water was moving in a very sort of steady pace. And And then the clouds in the sky were just very smoothly gliding across the moon. And he was thinking, gosh, you know, that moon, it's shining on Poland as well, isn't it? And he suddenly had this idea for this piece where there are two harps and 29 solo strings, and the two harps are representing the river, and there's a lovely, slow, very even pulsating rhythm, rocking rhythm throughout the piece, which stays the same. And then you have this amazing texture of all these solo strings in quarter tones, sliding chromatically through these quarter tones. And you can really see, you can feel that moment there with the moon sliding in and out of these clouds. And the moon is represented by, there are three solo instruments, the violin and then the viola and the cello play this beautiful Polish folk tune, which becomes the lullaby, and it sort of disappears behind the clouds and the sliding textures take over, and then it comes out again. And it's very atmospheric and very unusual.
And extraordinarily advanced, Nick, as well, isn't it? And didn't it turn out to have quite an influence on a future generation of Polish composers?
It was certainly in the back of the minds of Polish composers when, after Stalinism and the period of the Thaw, when gradually composers began to become more genuinely experimental again. There was certainly a memory. Panofnik's music had been banned in Poland by this point because he had defected by this point. But there was a strong memory of this piece which achieved a certain notoriety. And when you hear it this evening, you'll realise why.
We should talk a little bit about Lutosławski and how he came to terms with socialist realism and the impact it had on him, because he stayed and he had to find a different way of working with the system, didn't he?
Yes, he'd been stung by the system quite early on. His wartime composition is Symphony No. 1, and Symphony No. 1 is quite experimental. It's full of different styles, and he's pulling together into a symphonic vision. And the Vice Minister for Culture, Sikorski, a very powerful figure in Polish culture, as Stalinism came into play, said that a composer such as Lutosławski should be thrown beneath the wheels of a tram after the premiere performance in Warsaw of the First Symphony. So Lutosławski, yes, but he was being stung by the regime, but he also had to find a way of supporting his family, supporting his mother, and making his daily bread. He did compose some political pieces, and in later life, until he was somewhat older and more relaxed about talking about these things, he could sometimes be slightly disingenuous about whether or not he'd written mass songs to obviously political topics. A mass song, in Poland, if you haven't come across the term before, is essentially a militaristic choral pop song. And Lutosławski did write some on non-political subjects. There's one, a lovely one called I Should Marry. But most of them are on topics relating to the military, youth organizations, and there's a famous example called Nova Huta, which means new foundry, which is about an exciting new industrial development south of Krakow. And that's an example of the ways in which composers were coerced and pressured by the demands. He managed to steer away as much as possible from that kind of heavily tainted, doctrinally tainted work, by basing so much of his music of the period on the folk songs he'd already been working on in the post-war period. And so there's a series of works stretching from his folk melodies in 1945, his 20 carols, which are all based around folk melodies, in 1946, through to the Little Suite in 1950, the Bucolics in 1952, and most famously, Concerto for Orchestra, which he worked on between 1950 and 1954. And so his path through the mire was to focus on folk song. And this enabled him, essentially, to fashion compositional Trojan horses. Prokofiev once quipped that the thing that got denounced was formalism by the Stalinists, by the socialist realists, anything that was too complex. And Prokofiev said, basically, it was anything that a party official couldn't understand on first hearing a piece. Now, the last time I checked, that's a lot of stuff in most serious pieces that we don't fully understand on first hearing them. Lutosławski realized you could carry on all kinds of progressiveness in the accompaniments and the contrapuntal textures of your music if there was a folk melody or folk melody-like focus in the foreground of the music.
And we have Lutosławski's centenary celebrations this year. Your father's next year, Roxana. What are your hopes?
In the last sort of 30 years of my father's life, which would be the 1960s, 70s and 80s, he died in 91, I think classical concert audiences, a lot were rather scared off by contemporary music. While this was happening, my father was trying to find this perfect balance between your kind of intellectual development and structure of music, but the very heart and emotion of the music. And now, actually, his kind of music will be so much more embraced by concert audiences because it is emotional, it's passionate, it's warm, it's spiritual. And I want new ears to hear his music. And I hope your ears will enjoy it and take it away with you tonight.
Roxana Panufnik, Nicholas Rayland, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
That was Andrew McGregor, and tonight's Proms Plus was produced by Rebecca Bean. And this is Petroc Trelawney welcoming you back to the Royal Albert Hall, where tonight the Warsaw Philharmonic make their Proms debut under outgoing artistic director Anthony Witt. Panufnik and Shostakovich from them very shortly. They are receiving lots of support this evening from members of London's Polish community. Georgia is somewhere out there in the arena, I think, with a couple of Polish music lovers.
I am indeed, Petroc. Yes, I'm wedged into a corner of the very busy and rather warm arena floor here with two Polish prommers and one British one. The Poles felt they just had to be here this evening to hear their countrymen and women from the Warsaw Philharmonic play. Agata and Paweł. Agata, first of all, tell me, where are you from in Poland?
Gdańsk.
Gdańsk, and what about you, Paweł?
It just happened the same city, Gdańsk.
Okay, so somehow we managed to geographically come across two Poles from the same place here at the Albert Hall tonight. Why did you decide that you just had to be here? Was it for the orchestra or the music that they're playing?
It was mainly orchestra. I never seen Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra before, so I really, really wanted to see them, especially in London, which is kind of strange and exotic in a sense, but very familiar in the other.
And what about you, Paweł? Was it just to see the orchestra, or is this the music that just beguiled you here?
I was attracted to Lutosławski. I just wanted to take this opportunity to listen live interpretation of his music. He is such an important figure in the Polish and international classical music, so I thought it was great.
You wanted to hear his music. And I mean, there's a big focus on Polish music at the Proms this year, not just on Lutosławski, but Górecki, Paderewski, Szymanowski. I mean, we're really going for it with the Polish music this year. Do you think Polish music is really having a moment, that audiences are beginning to really realise that there's so much more than Chopin?
I think so. And I think also the Polish performers now feel entirely free to demonstrate what a artistry they represent and what a great composers we have. These composers that you mentioned, they've been on the forefront of the European classical music for many years, and now it is really showing through.
Agata, that Lutosławski that we heard in the first half, it's such a shining, crashing, amazing piece. It shows off the orchestra in so many ways, but it's also got these huge mood changes. It's wonderfully ecstatic one minute, rather melancholy the next. Does that say something about the Polish soul, do you think?
Definitely. We are unpredictable, like the music.
Like the music itself. Thank you so much for joining us. Back to you, Petroc.
Georgia, thank you very much indeed. So the platform is set, ready for Panufnik's tragic overture, written during World War II. Words of Julian Anderson, a brutal, overtly violent piece which was as direct a non-verbal protest against the Nazi regime as could be imagined. Anthony Witt conducts the Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra. Thank you.
Thank you.